You're listening to Charlottesville's Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email, sign up on our homepage. I'm Dan Gould. Delegates Rob Bell, Matt Ferris, Steve Lanz, and David Toscano provided their perspectives on issues that came before the 2012 legislature. The delegates spoke at the Wednesday, April 11, 2012 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Charlottesville Senior Center. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV Secretary Bill Davis.
Well, I'm Bill Davis, and I want to welcome everybody to the Senior Statesmen of Virginia meeting today. At this point in time, we only have two of our delegates that are here. Delegate Ferris has told us that he's not going to be able to attend today, and hopefully Steve Landis will come in. So if he does, we'll bring him up here. Okay, well, we'll get started. Actually, our two delegates today don't really need any introduction. They come every year and tell us what went on down in Richmond. And so we'll do this a little. We will take written questions. And if you'll hold your hand up if you need a card to fill out the question. And then after you complete it, just hold it up and somebody will come around and pick it up. One of our board members will pick it up. As I say, that neither one needs any introduction. We've got Rob Bell here, who is the Republican 58th District delegate. And, of course, David Toscano, who is our 57th District delegate. He's a Democrat. And what I'm going to do is just let these two gentlemen do their dog and pony show, as they usually do. Tell us about the General Assembly, cover what they want to. I think David has a PowerPoint he might want to show us. And then after that, we'll let them go as long as they need to. And then after that, we'll open it up for questions. And don't forget, if you have a question, write it down and hold up the card and we'll pick it up. David?
Good afternoon, everybody. It's great to be back with you, and it looks like this is maybe the biggest crowd we've had in a while. God, it's not even a state election year, but there is a federal election going on. We can comment on that later on. It's nice to be back with you. As you might know, this is my seventh year in the General Assembly. And I've got a little different job this year. I was elected the Democratic leader in the House, so I've got a few more things to do, a few more things on my plate, and a lot more stories to tell, let me tell you. But not that I'm going to tell you any of them. But I thought I'd come with a PowerPoint, and this is the first time we've used the PowerPoint this year since I got back. We're not really done. We have to go back next week to both vote on a new budget and also for what's called the reconvened or the veto session. That's the session where we consider all the bills that the governor has either vetoed or has changed in some fashion, and we have to decide whether we like what the governor did or what he didn't. But the big question is going to be whether the budget can be passed, and we're a little late this year. We think we're going to get one, shall we say, in due course, but when that's going to happen is not clear, and we're going down next week to do it. Now, every year, and Rob, you know, you don't have the benefit of seeing this thing, but every year I come with a little title to the presentation about what we did in the General Assembly. This year, you've heard it in the past, the good, the bad, and the ugly, or whatever the title was. This year it's called Probes, Personhood, Potholes, and Pensions. So, and we'll get to the various parts of that over time. There are a lot of really kind of funny things we do in the General Assembly. We pass things like the state flower. We didn't do that this year. It's already been done. State saltwater fish, I think you heard the story about that. Last year, we did that last year. This year, we didn't deal with the state reptile. You may have heard that story of several years ago where there was a bill in to create make this little guy the state reptile until they found that his name was Terrapin carolinus. And then we don't have a state game yet. We're going to probably work on that at some point in the future. So these things didn't happen. But there were some interesting bills. There was this bill that would have provided a tax credit if you send your cremated remains into space. Now, that's an interesting bill. It says left in finance. In other words, it didn't get to the House floor, so we didn't consider that. But we did consider this bill. Now, for those of you, how many of you go to NASCAR events? Well, now you can get mixed beverages at NASCAR events. This bill was passed, so kind of an interesting little bill. This is not the picture of the delegate. This is a picture of Rob. Okay, we did pass a bill that allows nighttime training of bear hunting dogs. That was a Freudian slip. And then, of course, we had this bill that doubled the amount of renewable energy credit a utility can earn if it's fueled primarily by animal waste. You can speculate on what that picture means. Most of the attention this year, of course, had to do with this, what I call social overreach, and that is supposed to be a fire burning, which indicates what's happened as a result of some of these bills that were put in. I'll give you some indication. There were 28 gun bills that were introduced this session, and a bunch of them, and most of them had to do with expanding the ability of people either to get guns, or take them to different places. The biggest one that got passed was the one gun a month repeal. That bill had been in, that law had been in place since the Wilder administration a long time. And it was repealed this year. It was signed by the governor. So you can get as many guns as you want on any particular day that you want, as long as you pass certain background checks. There was a proposal initially made by the Attorney General to arm Medicaid fraud investigators. It got turned into a bill. They decided it was going to cost too much money, and therefore it got left in appropriations and was not passed. I was always like the image of the fraud investigators showing up at nursing homes armed. That was an image that I really liked, but that bill didn't get passed. There was a bill that allowed people to that prevented localities from preventing people from bringing their guns to work sites. You can sort of speculate on the implication of that. That was passed, by the way. I think it's been signed by the governor. There was a bill that allowed people to carry their guns into airports. That was continued to 2013, which means that bill is still alive. So that's an indication. There was a bill that allowed that would have required drug testing of those people who receive public benefits. Usually people thinking of that as welfare recipients, right? Interesting, this bill pulls off the charts by... so you know, the public really likes this idea that we should drug test people who receive public benefits. But then you start asking your question, who actually does receive public benefits? And there are a lot of people who do, including major corporations who get tax breaks. Okay, tax credits, by the way. We did a lot with tax credits this year. I know Rob may talk about this, but I've talked a lot about tax credits. Tax credits are really... interesting little beast, because it's a way that the legislature funds things from year to year without them being reviewed. And so what happens is the more tax credits you put on the books, the less money you have to spend when time comes around to do a budget. And whether that's the right way to govern or not is not clear to me, because that takes all the oversight out of it. And you put these tax credits into effect, they sound like a good idea at the time. You're never reviewing them, and every year they're in the budget, and every year there's less money for schools or other kinds of things as a result. A lot of activity to authorize or extend tax credits. We'll have some more talk on this later. The intrusive ultrasound bill was the big bill of the year. That got the most play. I didn't bring the Jon Stewart Comedy Central thing. You can check it out on YouTube. It is pretty interesting, if it wasn't upsetting, at least to me. Ultimately, what got passed was a requirement that women undergo a medically unnecessary procedure that doesn't give them any information that's useful before they have an abortion. So the really, really bad bill didn't get passed, but a kind of bad bill, at least in my view, did get passed. Still out there, the personhood bill. The bill that gives constitutional rights to fertilized eggs. This isn't a fertilized egg, but these are things that we're not sure are people. There are lots of jokes being made about the personhood bill, but it's deathly serious business. If you're a lawyer or about to become a lawyer, if this bill passes, you need to get into this business because you will have so much litigation about what constitutes a person and what kind of rights they have that it will keep you rich for many, many years. I don't mean to make light of it. It's a really serious bill. That bill is still out there, by the way. Okay, the budget. The budget is a process. We've been working through it for the last few months. Long and short is the governor's budget had pretty draconian cuts in the social safety net and didn't do so well for K through 12 education. A lot of us fought about that for a long time, and the House budget was much improved in terms of spending for K through 12 education and did restore a lot of the cuts that the governor had made in his instituted budget. Right now, the budget is what is called a conference committee. That's a committee of the Senate and the House designed to reconcile the differences between the House version of the budget and the Senate version of the budget. And for what we have heard, and we haven't seen the final conference report, this budget will not have the diversion of sales tax revenue that would otherwise go to fund schools, public safety, etc., and sending that money to transportation. You might have read about that. That was a very controversial issue, that we would divert some of what's called the general fund and put it into transportation. In the conference report, that does not occur. There are some restoration of cuts to Medicaid and Medicare in the budget, even over and above what the House budget was. There's still money. There's more money in K through 12, but in my view, it still shortchanges K through 12. And there's some issues about VRS we can get to in a few minutes. The good thing in the budget, both the House budget and the conference report, has more money for higher education. That's really a good thing. The governor did take an initiative this year and put some more money in the budget for that. And it's a good thing because we've been shortchanging higher education for the last 10 years. You can see on some of these sheets that are coming up next, it'll show you how tuition has increased at UVA and PVCC. Hit next. See, this is the line, tuition increases. And the reason for that is that we're not adequately funding higher education. So when that happens, what's the result? If you want to keep good professors online, if you want to keep good facilities in place, you have to raise tuition. And see, this line shows tuition passing the line of general fund revenues that are coming from the state per student to support education. By the way, up here, I don't have the North Carolina line. It's way up above the Virginia line. Let's go. This shows what's happened to the PVCC tuition over the last 10 years. And again, for those people who want to go back to school or those people who don't have much money, the increases in tuition for the community college systems have really grand, unbelievable impacts on their ability to get a good education. Okay, let's keep going because we got to give Rob some time. There is some money for the Cancer Center in the budget. The Charlottesville train has a two-year reprieve. It's going to continue for at least 2 years. Most efficient running train in the state system that's operated by Amtrak. Great pilot program. Hopefully we can keep that thing. If you've ridden it recently, you can't even get a seat on it. Albemarle and Charlottesville get a little bit more money in the conference report. There's no money transferred from Charlottesville schools to Albemarle schools. A judgeship will potentially be filled as a result of the budget. And for those who are interested, we did get our bill passed that helps Habitat for Humanity in their efforts in and around the Biscuit Run property. I've talked long enough. Those are some of my bills, some of the things that failed also. I'm glad to take questions
Rob's Dave done. Did a nice overview of some of the things that I would call some of our successes, some of our failures, some of the things we worked on. The other Republican delegate, I'll leave some time for him if he shows up, is Steve Landis. He is actually on the budget. Actually, the problem with this is I can't see everybody. You're not missing much. The way the budget works is the House passes a budget, the Senate passes a budget. This year it was a little procedurally complicated because they couldn't pass their own budget, so they just amended ours. The result is the same. There's a House version and a Senate version. Both the House and Senate then select a group of people to negotiate the final compromise. Neither David nor I is on that august group, but Steve Landis is. And they've worked for the last couple of weeks, and we've been told that there is white smoke on the budget, and we understand that a budget compromise has been reached. And I have not seen it yet. Have you seen it, David?
Well, they don't publish it until...
I know, but you're... Yeah, right. David is the newly important and powerful minority leader. I thought there might be some excess. Okay. He has a much better office than he used to have. More staff, too. We have not yet seen it. I understand they're going to release it Saturday or Sunday, and then we'll have a few days to look at it, and then we'll go back down on Tuesday or Wednesday, I guess, to actually have our votes. And at this point, we are hearing the various things that David was presenting, specifically, for instance, the judgeship. I don't know if have you been told this. The judgeship, we've been told, is in fact in the budget. So this will only matter to every lawyer in the room, but also anybody who thinks they might have a lawsuit in the next 5 years will have quicker access to the judicial system because we have five judges locally rather than just four. It seems very obscure, but to those of us that need it, you'll be there 6 months faster than you would be otherwise. There were a number of bills that passed, several that failed, and then obviously the biggest issue was the budget this year. Just in broadest strokes for the budgetary issues, because so much of what we do is impacted by the budget, the budget revenues are rebounding finally, but are still substantially below what they were at the height. And what that means is that you have all the pressures that you've heard about us talk about each couple of years are still there. In addition, every year there are some additional pressures. Medicaid costs go up inexorably every year. We have to, those come out of the bottom line, so to speak. And in addition, I know you have talked about this before, there are what we call counter-cyclical pressures, meaning in bad times, we actually have to spend more on certain things, job retraining, workers, unemployment benefits, welfare. Some of those things actually go up in hard times. So the pressures on the rest of the budget remained. You're going to hear, I think, over the course of today, many times where people say, I would like to have more money for whatever the project is. And the short reason why we don't have more money is because of all these other pressures on the budget. So the budget this year we expect to have on Tuesday, and by then hopefully, again, we could give you more concrete answers about what's actually going to be in it. With regards to substantive bills, we had some bills, I think, that didn't get as much attention as some of the issues that Dave talked about. I'm going to bring them up. If you have questions about them, this will be to sort of prompt the inquiry, and if you don't care, then we won't talk about them any further. One that I think was really neat that came out of some work that was done all year round was to expand the ability of nurse practitioners to deliver health care. Now, I suspect nobody in this room has heard of this, but this is one that over the long term will be very helpful. Everybody believes that there is a problem with access to health care, especially in parts of the state. Now, we are very lucky in Charlottesville to have both Martha Jeff and UVA in a very active sort of medical practice here. But don't go far. Go an hour south of here or an hour southwest of here, and you start to hit places that do not have easy and local access to doctors. We have loosened the requirements for how much oversight a nurse practitioner must have. We've made it part of a team rather than direct oversight. Again, this sounds very obscure, but what it does is it means the nurse practitioner can deliver certain kinds of health care that she couldn't used to be able to deliver. And in some communities, that will be the difference between having someone there in the field and having to drive 2 hours to get to an actual doctor's office. This was a year-long project. It sounds like this would be obvious, but in fact, the doctors are very concerned that there'd be sufficient oversight. Other nurses' groups wanted into the box. The final compromise was worked out this year. Let me talk to you about public safety only because it's something I know a lot about. These are bills that either I wrote or came through my subcommittee, which is the criminal law subcommittee. We have been looking at the problem of crime in Virginia forever. And the world divides, we think, into two groups when you look at the criminals. The first would be those who are irredeemably evil and we have to simply lock them up to keep them away from everybody else. Thank God that's the minority of the people we see in our court system. The majority are whatever you want to call them, meatheads, knuckleheads, trouble causers, people that cause great harm, but we're hopeful that we don't have to keep them locked up for the rest of their life. And we have been trying to find solutions. You can imagine the solution for one is not necessarily the solution for the other. We had bills this year to address each of those. Let me give you two examples and we can talk more further. The first would be in the first category. We have a group of offenders who rape children under 12. There were 228 of them over the last 2 years. The average sentence is only 13 years, which means if they do it in their 20s, they'll be out again to reoffend in their 30s and out again to reoffend in their 50s. All the studies say that these gentlemen never age out. Armed robbery, you kind of stop doing it at age 40. Every man in the room could visualize at age 40, you're just too tired to go rob a liquor store. That is not true for sex offenders. And so the bill this year was to finally address the problem head on. We have looked at the edges and looked at the edges and looked at the edges, and we finally just said, that's it. If you are convicted of raping a child of 12 or under, we will give you life in prison. Period, end of story. That's a bill that passed this year. It's being signed by the governor. In the second category, these guys who just never seem to get their message straight, We are going to try a pilot project. I just understood that this was included in the budget. And what it is, it's modeled on a program in Hawaii. And what happens is people who are not in that first category, they get convicted, they go to jail, they get out, and now they're on probation. And our track record for probationers are not very good. In point of fact, most of them, not most, almost most, just under half, reoffend anyway despite all of our current probationary practices. And so we are always looking for ways to say, here's an identified population, half of whom are going to commit a crime in the next 5 years. What can we do to stop them, convince them, cajole them, threaten them, whatever we got to do to make sure they don't? And Hawaii has come up with this program called Project Hope, and it is having extraordinary outcomes, and it's very simple. It actually just says that any time there's any violation, be it ever how small, there will be some kind of penalty related to that sanction, to that mistake. You probably think that's how probation works. It's not. That's not how regular probation works. But what they said is, if you're 20 minutes late for your appointment, that's 2 days in jail. If you have a dirty screen, that's a weekend in jail. If you lose your job because you cussed the boss and we told you not to, that's a weekend in jail. And what they've discovered is, instead of just punishing people and putting them in prison, it's actually modifying conduct, which is in theory the goal of what we're trying to get at. We don't know if it will translate to Virginia. I'd like to think it will. What I do know is we ought to try it. And so we are going to try it in some pilot projects. They've got 4 pilot projects they want to identify. The goal would be to have that translate, and we'll try to do that in the future and hopefully get the recidivism rate down. Let me give you 2 more. I think everybody followed what happened up in Pennsylvania with Penn State. We have added to the list of people that have to report child abuse those who work at universities. And we saw what happened there. I hope it won't happen here. And now a university employee who sees crime being committed against a child will have to report it. The 4th would be something called ignition interlock devices. This is if you get a drunk driving ticket and you want to get a restricted license, that's what most of them want to do to keep a job. This says you'll have to breathe into the ignition interlock to prove you're not drunk again, because we have so many drunk drivers who do it, get convicted, and do it again. Again, this is something we're lifting from another state that does this. We think that they've had good outcomes. We hope that we will too. Let me not spend all of my time talking about issues that are of interest to me, but leave plenty of time for questions. One big issue that we could spend the whole day talking about, and I just want to make sure that you all know that it's out there, the issue about the VRS underfunding is critical, and really a lot of these little things will be subsumed by it if we don't take care of it. And let me just put the numbers out there. Virginia Retirement System, it's the primary vehicle for retirement funds for Virginia State employees. Is anybody here on VRS? Okay, so maybe a 4th. We have more people in our community just because we have more government employees than some other communities have. The problem with the VRS fund is as follows. It has money in it. It's not like Social Security. It has actual stocks and bonds and cash. I don't have today's figure, but it's roughly $50 billion. Real money, $50 billion. The problem is that the actuaries have projected out what we currently owe against what is currently there, and we come in $19.9 billion short. Now, that you're used to hearing Washington numbers, $19.9 billion, who cares, who knows what that means. $19.9 billion is in the ballpark of our entire state general fund for a year. So what I mean is, if we didn't spend a single penny on every single thing we're going to talk about for the next 90 minutes, that would pay off the fund. It's that big a hole. The second problem is, right now, at least until July 1st, every new employee who is hired makes it a little bit worse. In other words, we have a system set up where we are making it worse every year. This is an enormous problem, and it's the same problem that has sunk California, that is sinking Illinois, and has got New Jersey in big trouble. And our goal would be to say we have a narrow window in which to do something. None of the solutions will make people happy. They both involve decreasing benefits for future hires and finding some way to try to bend the cost curve, they call it, for current employees and current retirees. All of these are hard choices, and it's because we have a $19.9 billion hole. And so I'd be happy to talk about what we've done in the past few years, happy to talk about what we did this year. Most of the changes in this year's bill will involve new hires, not existing retirees or existing employees. But we certainly have to make changes going forward, or the system will just not be there. Probably not for people in this room, I'm guessing at the age, but anybody under a certain age, under 45, there will be no money there when they get there to retire. And so we have to do something now while we still can. With that, I'd like to stop talking. I don't see that Steve has come. Okay, so we'll just take questions. Thank you, everybody.
Okay, here's the first question. It's a little lengthy, and I'm going to read it. In a letter dated February 22, 2012, Delegate Steve Landage reported a survey of his constituents showed the 3 topics of most concern were 1, education, 2, transportation, and 3, the jobs and economy. My question is, given the above, why were we presented with House Bill 1, which dealt with personhood and buy as many guns as you can carry out bills, an invasive abortion bill? To the best of my knowledge, you didn't deal with transportation, and you postponed education or kicked it back to the localities, et cetera. So the question is, why doesn't the legislature deal with the problems that the people are most concerned with?
The truth is, most of the bills that we take up each year are not controversial, not in the newspaper. We pass about 700 every year, and I defy anyone, including David or me, to name, you know, more than three or four dozen of them. I have here a list that I actually asked Jordan to help prepare, and I could go down it. I think your eyes would glaze over, but here's, you know, 13 jobs bills of various sorts that try and help improve employment situation in Virginia. On the education, for instance, there was sort of arguably the most dramatic changes in, there's a school choice measure, not even mine, that would involve scholarships for kids in underperforming school districts. Whether you love it or hate it, I had a very substantial bill with regards to homeschooling and access to high school athletics. It didn't pass, but that was a bill that we took up. We had a bill that passed the House to say that school boards could set their own calendar. That may sound like something that's obvious to you, but in fact they can't. They call it the King's Dominion Law or the Labor Day Law. Those were just the education bills. The budget is an extraordinarily significant document in terms of setting priorities, and it doesn't have anything to do with the issues that were raised on the sort of the negative side of the ledger. You may agree or disagree about whether we should allocate what we call general fund monies to transportation. You may think that we should reserve those for education. You may think that transportation is a core government service. David and I disagree on that. But those are the issues that take up most of our time. Now, it is absolutely true that any member can file any bill that they want. And there was a Democratic delegate, Melvin, who every year would stand up near the end of session and say, our problem is that legislative services are so good that they can turn anything into a bill. And it's true. Any notion we have at 4 in the morning that sounds like a good idea, you send it to them, and voila, there's a bill that will have to go to a committee and have to get voted on. But it's not true that the only things we do are the high-profile bills. Now, that said, I understand what people write about them. It's all very interesting. The newspapers prefer it because there's such hot conflict about them. And some of them are very important, and I'm not trying to minimize how important they are, but we certainly do try. I mean, I would encourage anybody to come down to watch my subcommittee. We'll be there till 11 or 12 at night, trying to decide who should go to jail, who should be let free, and what sort of the criteria will be. And I don't think you'll find us. I think you would think that we're focusing on important things. But
well, it is true that any delegate can put in any bill they want. But it isn't true that every delegate has to vote for a bad bill that an individual delegate puts in. And that's the problem. The problem is you got too many people voting for these bills that don't really speak to the big concerns that Virginians have. I told you I wouldn't tell you any stories, but I will tell you a story about this personhood bill. This is not the first year we've seen a bill that's like that. That bill was introduced a couple of years ago. And the leadership in the House really didn't want that bill to go anywhere because it was going to be too potentially embarrassing for folks. And so what they did is they sent it to a subcommittee, and then they put a bunch of Democrats on it that they knew would kill the bill. And then that subcommittee met late one night, took testimony for 4 hours, and then killed the bill. It was a pretty close bill to what this personal bill was. What was interesting about that testimony was that the people who came to argue for the bill were none other than the Solicitor General of the Commonwealth of Virginia, appointed by the Attorney General Cuccinelli. And so it's not just a fringe element here that's supporting these kind of bills. So now this bill comes up, this personhood bill this year, and it gets heard by committee. Didn't it get heard by our committee?
Yep.
Yeah, got heard by our committee. Got heard in my subcommittee. I vote against the bill in the subcommittee. Gets heard by the full committee. Goes steaming out on a party line vote. Gets to the House floor, and they're now 60-some delegates who are members of the Republican caucus, and they almost all vote for it. Okay, so it passes the House. And there was a lot of argument about that bill. The ultrasound bill, we not only debated that once, twice. I think we've debated it three or four times. Both the bad bill and the less bad bill. So I don't know if people want to say that, you know, they want the conservatives to introduce more bills like this. I mean, these are enough bills for me. I mean, we don't need any more bills like this. We should be focused on jobs. We should be focused on the economy. We should be focused on the budget. This distracts from it, and it's up to the leadership of the Republican majority in the House to basically say, like the governor said in his State of the Union, stop overreaching, guys. Let's focus on what people think are important. It's got to come from the leadership.
Okay, this is for both delegates. How did you vote on House Bill 321 and why? And can you explain the bill's highlights? And given the dire fiscal pressure on school districts, why not vote public funds to private schools?
This is a tax credit bill for the...
Yeah, we don't... believe it or not, right. We don't usually use the numbers.
Some people know all these numbers, but I never remember the numbers.
Hold on. I'll check.
But
start talking.
Is this a tax credit bill?
Yeah, it is.
Okay,
it
yeah,
is.
There's a bill. It was authored by a gentleman from Henrico, and it sort of mirrors a number of bills that are floating out there in the country that would give tax credits to corporations who fund youngsters who would want to go to private schools. And I voted against that bill. I didn't think it was appropriate to be using tax dollars to move kids out of the public schools, especially at a time when we have these budget problems that we have. And you know, I'm concerned about these kind of bills generally. You know, that being said, there are some arguments for that bill, but I think on balance, I think it's not a bill that we should be supporting at this particular time.
So I take a different view. I think that the bill itself, what it does is it says that we will provide tax credits if you will pay into a scholarship fund. Basically, it sets up a scholarship fund, and the scholarship fund would be available to children. There's two criteria: underprivileged kids in underperforming districts. So these are places where the kids have schools that are just not giving them the education that they need or deserve, and they come from families that have no other options, that can't afford to go anyplace else. And I respectfully disagree with Delegate Toscano on this. I think that with David on this, we have school choice in America and in Virginia. It's called being rich, and if you have wealth here, you can choose whatever school you want. And if you're in a bad school district, which you're probably not because you're already from a middle class area, you can still choose to go to STAB or Covenant or a Catholic school or all these other choices. The only people we consign to a school where they absolutely don't want to go and which is underperforming are those who don't have the economic ability to get another choice. I don't see why that is a defensible position to be in. Now, it is true that if you said, well, golly, if we could just put that money into the public school and the public school would be terrific and every kid there would get a good education, that is a nice thing to talk about, but some of these schools have had trouble for decades. And it is naive to pretend that if we just give them a couple more years, somehow they will fix the problems they've not been able to fix for decades. And instead, what you're doing is taking a cohort of kids and saying, you just can't. You do not get a choice. And it's why in places like Washington, where they do have anything like this, there's always a long line of parents who are trying to get in. Now, I don't think it's cost-free, so I'm not a Pollyanna either. I think that when you do this, obviously you are, you know, are empowering those families that are there, but you got to work with the other families that are not taking advantage of the program. But I think that to say that under no circumstances are we going to provide an alternative to the local public school, that singular choice, the local public school, no matter how bad it might be, no matter how disadvantaged you might be, I think that that's not fair to those kids. Thank you.
Okay, the next one, the Virginia retirement system over the years has opted to change from relatively secure bonds to include some riskier equities, which has resulted in severe fund losses in the current session. Do you, either of you have a comment on that?
Do you want to go?
You can go.
All right. I'll be happy to talk about VRS all day, and it's not because it's a good topic. In fact, it's a very painful topic, but because it's so important. The numbers are so big. Governor McDonald this year put $2.1 billion into VRS. It wasn't just all state money. It was from various sources and localities and everything else. $2.1 billion, an enormous slug of money, the biggest slug of money we've ever had. It only gets us back to where we were 2 years ago. I mean, it doesn't fix anything. It just dials the clock back 2 years ago. We still have, by according to what you're counting, is a $19.9 billion shortfall. All right, the problem with VRS are twofold. As recently as 1999, VRS was fully funded. In fact, it was arguably slightly overfunded. They had had an aggressive investment program, had reached a point where basically it was everybody else who was privately invested can remember. The late 90s were a terrific time. All of a sudden, it crested over and was fully funded. Terrific. We actually have the system fully funded. And what has happened since then is instead of switching to, I think the gentleman said bonds, but let's just call it a less risky investment approach, they continue to be. And you can, there's a gentleman here in town, I won't tell you his name, but he was on the VRS board, and he has always said, the moment it was fully funded, we should have defeased the whole thing. In other words, gotten out of the business of having a retirement system and just purchased annuities on the market, because that's actually what they cost. You can pretend you're going to do better, but what you're basically saying at that point is, I can beat the market. Our investors are so smart, they can get it cheaper. What does get it cheaper means? That means beat the market. Those things are available. We didn't do it. Well, here we are, and it's been, I guess, since 1999, so 13 years later. During good years, we did not put the money in because it didn't look like we needed to. So when the stocks were really rolling, we said, gosh, we don't need to put the money in. In a bad year, when we lose $5 billion, well, gosh, nobody says we can put $5 billion in. And so then we don't make up the money in the bad years either. We arrive at where we are. I think that we have nothing but painful choices at this point. Now, I will say the money all got spent on useful things. And Dave's been coming here for 7 years. I've been here for 10. I don't recall, and somebody can correct me, but I don't recall of all the various funding requests we've always gotten, somebody saying, don't give money to blank, put it in the retirement fund. And I'm not being cute. I mean, in other words, and it's the same thing that happened at Richmond. The teachers come, and they either want more teachers or more pay or better schools or something, but they're not saying, please put it in VRS. And the universities are saying, we need better buildings or whatever. We don't put it in VRS. The problem is the horizon is too far off. This will not arrive until David and I are long and gone. So we don't. Nobody wants to focus on it. I really do think that the painful medicine we're going to take this year we'll have more next year, and the goal has to be to have a system that is there for the current retirees, which I assume are most of the people in this room, the people that are about to retire who can't make any other choices, and then for the person who's 21 just or 18, just got out of high school, took a job with VDOT, and has started working and wants his program to vest and ultimately get retirement down the road. It's got to be there for all of them. And so I think that this is, we should talk about this for the whole day just because the numbers are so big.
Sure. Yeah, we could talk about it for the whole day, and it is very complicated. And the first question really has to do is what really is an unfunded liability and how does it manifest itself? You know, there's some, when you hear that number, you think, well, they'd have to pay out all the benefits tomorrow, you know, and that isn't the way it works. You pay out the benefits over time. So even though it's a big number, it's not a number that is totally insurmountable to deal with. The retirement account is a function of the investment that you make in it. It's just like your own account. I mean, if you don't invest in your own account, you won't have any money to retire, and the performance of the investments that you have. So twofold. And that question is really having to do with the second part of it and whether you should have moved over to bonds at some point in time. You know, I'm not on that trustee board, so I can't really comment about whether they made right or wrong decisions. But I can say this. The reason why we're underfunded is not really because of the performance by itself. It's because we haven't invested. And that's a function of political will. And the legislature has not been willing to step up for the last probably 10 to 12, even longer than that. I think it's 18 out of 20 years we have funded at a rate that is less than had been recommended, including a couple years ago, where we decided, well, you know, we just weren't going to fund it enough and use the money in other places to fund our other parts of the budget. That was one of the reasons I voted against that budget. And so now we are where we are. This notion that somehow we can fix this problem by laying it on the localities or on the workers is a fiction. Even the bill that the governor proposed does not, quote, fix the problem. The only way the problem gets fixed is you have to have an influx of a lot of capital over a sustained period of time. The bill that has been proposed has a requirement that the legislature ante up for the next 6 years, but there's no requirement that they do that. And you hear about all the fixes in this bill that's going to fix the problem. It doesn't fix the problem. The problem only gets fixed if the legislature steps up. That's going to take cash. Where's that cash coming from? can't raise taxes, can you? So where is it coming from? It's going to come from somewhere, and it's going to come from priorities. So don't be misled into thinking that the governor or the bills that you're seeing being passed are fixing the problem. They are going to make, they are going to give a little bit less benefit to some of employees, and they're going to make some benefits for new employees less lucrative over time. But they are not, but this measure is not fixing the problem for present or future employees.
I'm not responding. Can I say something about that? I mean, there's two problems, and they're related, but they're not the same. And I'm not disagreeing. Actually, I'm agreeing with you. The problem of the current liability, we owe $20 billion we don't have. We, Virginians, we owe it. We've told people we will pay it. In theory, you could have some action that would change the contract, but we agreed to pay that money. It's there. It's already out the door. We have to, over the next, it's just a mortgage, guys. I mean, it's $1 billion a year for 20 years, less interest issues. But, I mean, it's a lot of money over time, just what David said. Either we need lucky investing, which we tried before and that's not working, or we need a sustained amount of money going right into it. The second is we're digging the hole. Right now, absent some changes, now we're hopeful that the changes we made this year will at least stop it at 20. What I mean is, right now, again, somebody who got fired, I forget what our vesting is right now, 3 years or five? I think it's, okay. 5 years ago, so in, that's what I mean. In 2007, somebody got hired on April 11th, and he is about to vest right now. Somebody at DMV office or VDOT or tax department or some public employee, the moment he vests, our problem got a little bit worse, as it will for everybody else who was hired over the last 5 years. These are dual problems, but we need to fix them both, because obviously if we just try to fix the new hires, we still have the $20 billion we owe. If we just fix the 20 without making it harder, we're going to have another 20. At some point, this will keep going forward. And again, we are in this together, and I think that in this, the politicians have been reflective of the requests we get, which is this has not been at the top of anybody's priority list, because all of us are thinking about this year, 5 years, 10 years, not 30 years out. I mean, if you are currently a retiree, you could say, to heck with all of this. There's plenty in there for anybody over the age of 60. Plenty. We got $50 billion of real assets. We could pay you out and not worry about any of it. It's just, I think that's irresponsible in the long run not to say at some point this will come a cropper. We can make it a lot easier if we start to glide into it rather than we just wait till we run out of money and then try to fix it then. And obviously no one is seriously advocating that. It's just a question of how quickly and how aggressively we try to address it.
This is addressed to Delegate Toscano, but Mr. Bell can comment if he'd like to. Aside from this being a Dillon rule state, please explain why Charlottesville must go to the state legislature to hold a referendum on an election by mixed ward and at large.
I think it's in the charter, but I think it's in the charter that you have to do that. You have to change the charter, and municipalities are creatures of the state, and the only way you change the charter is by going to the state legislature and asking for a change. And so the only way that Charlottesville would get that change is they would request it from me, because I represent the city, or Cree Deeds, Senator, and then we would submit a bill that would change the charter of Charlottesville to create a mixed ward system. It's not a constitutional requirement.
This next one is, how did you vote on the ultrasound before abortion bill, and why did you vote as you did, and how will these tests be paid for? This is for both of you.
How many times?
I voted for it. I mean, I voted for it. I think that we have an informed consent rule in Virginia where we require certain information to be made available to a woman before she has an abortion, and I think that to those of you who think abortion is like any other medical procedure, this whole idea is wrong. And so whether you make it a little bit, a lot, small, big, you don't like the idea. And I understand, and I've talked to many of you over the last 10 years, and I appreciate it. I think you are in good faith, and you're saying you truly believe it. And so I don't have any question about your motives. I just come up with a different conclusion, which I do think abortion is different. And so there's a list of things that we do require someone who wants to get an abortion. And you can go look them up. It's called the informed consent law in Virginia. And I thought this fit within that as a part of informed consent. I understand that there are people who disagree about the whole idea. There's another who agree with informed consent but disagree with how this went forward. And then obviously there are some people who agree with me. Thank you.
Yeah, the idea of informed consent is that you tell somebody about a procedure and then they can either decide to do it or not. And this is totally different. This is something that where you have to do it, whether you want to or not, and it's got to stay in your record for forever that you either had it or you didn't. But the thing that's really troubling about this is it shows how folks really don't listen to the debate and they really don't read the bills carefully. When this bill first hit the House floor, we looked at this bill and we said, well, look, you know, this is going to require a special kind of ultrasound, a one that requires a probe being inserted into the vagina of a woman, because you're not going to get the required result that the bill suggests, which is to determine gestational age. And it's a certain age of a fetus. You can't determine gestational age with a what they call jelly on the belly ultrasound. I've learned so much, too much about this stuff, and I've used too many words both in front of 14-year-old pages and outside of their presence. It's not a pleasant experience. But we went ahead and we looked at this bill. He said, no, you know what this bill does? This bill requires the insertion of this probe, at least in most cases. And they said, oh, no, that's not what it requires. No, that's not what it requires. Well, then that bill just whizzes out of the House, goes over to the Senate. Well, you know, they're looking at it, too, and they say, yeah, that's what it requires. And so they pass it anyway, and they send it back to us, and then we had the debate again. Okay? And so finally, after it had been passed out of the House again, well, actually, not before, just before it gets passed out of the House again, somebody woke up, and they woke up because they got seeing Jon Stewart on Comedy Central, and they saw the firestorm that was being created. And the governor got involved, and he said, oh, my God, I'm running for vice president. I can't let this happen. And so he got together with a group of people in his office one night, and they worked up some compromise, which satisfied them. And so now the procedure is that you have to have a jelly on the belly ultrasound, but if you decide you're going to reject the probe, you can do that. But the jelly on the belly is not going to give you any medically necessary information. So what do you got? You got intimidation. That's what you got. And you got the legislature, for one of the first times in history, telling doctors what they need to do to serve their patients for this particular goal, which is to try to discourage people from having abortions. If you want to do that, there are lots of good ways to do that, but this is not really one way to do that, at least in my view, that makes much sense. Now, who's going to pay for it? Well, okay, the Senate Democrats wanted to put in a rider on the budget that would require the state to pay for it, because after all, the state's requiring it. That's been rejected. So if the bill's been signed, and so the only ones going to pay for it are the women themselves, unless there's some kind of insurance that's available. And so what you got, and potentially insurance companies could say, hey, this isn't a medically necessary procedure anyway, because it doesn't give you any information that helps medicine. So why should we pay for that? And I think you can see the problem with this bill, and I think that's because people are so focused on some of this social agenda that they lose track of things. And I think we're going to see this next time, too, because some of these bills are still out there, including that personhood bill. I think we're going to see it again.
If we are so concerned about tax credits, why not introduce legislation to require a periodic review on sunsetting of them?
A great question. Actually, Steve should be here, too, because both Steve Rentlandis and I introduced legislation to do that. The JLARC, the Joint Legislative Audit and Review Committee, which is our independent analyst of state policy issues, did a study of tax credits. You're talking about billions of dollars a year that are implicated by these credits, and oftentimes they're never even reviewed. We really don't understand how they work very well. They singled out the coal tax credit, which is 30-some million dollars a year, which was enacted in the I guess it was the mid-'80s or maybe the mid-'90s, but maybe the mid-'90s. allegedly to help the coal industry, and they said, well, we're not even sure it really works very well, and people ought to consider repealing it. So I put in a bill to repeal it, and that didn't go anywhere. And in fact, there was a bill designed to extend it, and that did go somewhere, and that passed. But what I had proposed is creating a commission, that joint Senate-House commission, that would review these things on a periodic basis, make sure they were doing what they were supposed to be doing. After all, if you're going to provide incentive to an industry through a tax credit, maybe they don't need that incentive after some period of time, and maybe you could use the money to provide an incentive for another industry that would use it. That bill, Steve put in a bill that created a committee of the House Finance and the House Finance and Appropriations and Senate Finance to look at these credits. My bill eventually got rolled into his, so that bill's become law. I thought it should be a more expansive committee that should include people that are not on the finance committees, because oftentimes, you know, the insights of folks like Rob and I, who don't serve on those exalted status position in committees, should have some sway in the legislature. But I think that's a good sign. I think we've changed the debate about tax credits. I think people are looking at them much more carefully. And I think we're going to get a better analysis of which ones work and which ones don't.
This is to Delegate Bell. And I'm not going to read this entire thing, but to paraphrase it, this is about the sex offender registry. And this person is asking if this person doesn't believe that the vast majority of Virginia boys listed on the sex offender registry are actually sexual predators, sexual deviants, or pedophiles. Because a boy can get on the sex offender registry simply by acquisition, so forth and so on. The question is, have you or your office done any systematic study on how these laws are used by people in the community, and has this actually made Virginia communities safer?
All right, there's about six parts to that. All right, so that sex offender registry has multiple parts based on what the sex offense is, and based on the seriousness of the sex offense is how, where we put you, how long you've got to stay, what options you have for getting off of the list. And you don't have to go look at the list, but you can go look at it if you choose, and you'll see that they range from the most serious offenses to those that are a closer call. Every year we look at the list itself to see if there's something we wish to add or take off. In candor, I can't recall us taking things off, but we certainly have looked at it. And we have put additional offenses on as they have come up for an offense that we think ought to be in the sex offender registry. Now, the registry itself, the goal is very simple, which would be we think that everyday citizens should be able to look up their neighbors if need be to see if there's some issue. Now, you can decide that you think that's a bad idea, and if you do, you don't like the registry at all. But for those of us, and I'll give you an example, I have a 9-year-old boy, I've got a 3-year-old daughter, they play in the neighborhood cul-de-sac with people. We have, in fact, looked up our cul-de-sac to just see if any of the people who they are playing with, whether they come from families, whether any of the kids that they play with, whether the houses they go in to visit when they want to play, you know, Xbox or whatever, are in fact on the registry. Now, I'm not sure I agree with the premise that none of the people or a low percentage of the people on the registry are not at risk. We've done recidivism studies of sex offenders, and there are some that are not, they're more likely and less likely to reoffend. In the big picture, those who commit crimes within families are more likely to keep it within families going forward. So if you're not part of that family, your risks are lower than someone who has a sort of a stranger rape issue. There's a issue about those who are by opportunity versus those who seek it out, if, different ways to categorize it. But I think, when we talk to voters about this, they absolutely want to be able to look up people. Now, there's a larger inquiry about whether we've reached a point, whether criminal backgrounds, sort of they're secret only sort of, because you can go look up right now anybody in Albemarle County. Right now, you can look up Toscano or Bell or somebody else and see their entire local record. But the only way to look up their whole record is to pan through 139 counties. Lexis already has a way that they supposedly can do this, which is a service that you can pay them $5 or something and you can get a criminal registry. Whether keeping it partially secret makes sense anymore, I don't know. But I do support the sex offender registry. I think it's used by people all the time.
This question. An aerial photograph of the fighter aircraft crash scene in Virginia Beach recently shows several, actually many, burnt-out apartment units. And the walls between the apartments appear to be only wooden partitions. Why doesn't Virginia have a fire code requiring at least cedar block walls at least equal to the roof height to prevent such damage and potential loss of life?
Good question. I don't know the answer to that, and I don't think Rob's saying he doesn't either. So
I don't know how much of that is. I don't know how much of that is local and how much is state. In other words, we have rules that we let each locality develop, and then we obviously have rules that we impose down from Richmond. I don't know how much of the fire code is which. You might know from your...
I don't know, but somebody, whoever, minority leader, I don't know if it's mayor or minority leader. I mean, there's somebody in this room who has some idea about this, but maybe they can come and see us afterward and educate us a little bit more about their understanding.
In 2011, the House passed a photo ID legislation easily. This year, the ID requirements for voting were loosened rather than tightened. Why the turnaround?
I'm not sure the facts are right.
I don't think that's true. I think they were tightened, except now that the governor has loosened them. It's the strangest thing. I mean, we've had these voter ID, we've had these provisions for a while, and you know, if you go there and you don't have an ID, you sign that sworn affidavit that's punishable by, I think it's a felony, if I'm not mistaken, that if you falsify your name or such, you can be thrown in jail, prosecuted as a felony. We had these things operating for a while in Virginia. All the studies suggest that there's no incidence of fraud. And yet people want to change the voter ID provisions of the code. So a bill did get passed. It was a kind of a convoluted bill because it had all these exceptions in it. And then the governor further convoluted it by putting back in what appeared to be what was close to what we had before. I haven't looked at the recent language, but it seems to me that the governor has now just reinserted another bureaucratic obstacle to people voting. And I don't quite understand why, so I'm going to have to look at it more carefully. But I don't think we loosened things up. I think, if anything, they were tightened this year.
Let me talk about the bill. I forget the bill number. It was Delegate Mark Cole's bill. And everybody in here who has voted in Virginia knows you go up, you present ID. If you don't present ID, they ask you to fill out. You can sign the affidavit and say, I am who I say I am, and then you can vote. Unless you have worked the polls, and probably some of you have, you don't know what happens next, which is once you sign the affidavit, your vote goes into the pile. And that's a very technical term for what I mean is you can't get it back out. And that will give you an example. If someone comes up and says, I'm David Toscano, do you have ID? No, I don't. I'll sign it. That person then votes, and then 2 p.m., David comes out of the law office where we both work, and he goes down to vote and says, I'm David Toscano. And they will say, well, you can't. You've already voted. There is no way to go back and find that vote. You could spend $1 billion. That vote is in the pile. What the bill this year said would be that if, in fact, you don't have ID, they will let you cast a ballot, but we will treat it as a provisional ballot. And what that means is that the vote doesn't go in the pile. It's set aside. And the next day, they call it the canvas, and maybe some of you have attended the canvas. They will go through the votes and see if David Toscano voted twice or is there something else he needs to do. The governor's amendment, one of the things he did was he said you can check the signature rather than have the person come in. So if the person is able to fake a signature on an affidavit and is close enough to the voter card, that'll be enough to get the person in. If they can come in the next day and say that they are the person who voted, they can do that. They can even show up with an electric bill or something, just something to show that they are, in fact, Delegate Toscano, or David Toscano, rather. The big thing, though, the big benefit, if you care about this kind of thing, is that if there's a problem, the vote isn't counted. Now, in the vast majority of elections, it's not close. Who cares? I mean, it's 1,000 votes. The canvas is done very quickly, and the amount of votes in play is not enough to matter. But if you have an election like we had last year, and I don't know if anybody participated, Bryce Reeves' election was the election upon which the Senate hung. It was 20-19. He was a Republican. The final tally, I forget, it was like 200 votes out of, I forget, tens of thousands of votes cast. That was the first canvas I'd ever participated in. Boy, we went through every single one. And they called people in, and there were some numbers that weren't right, and we had to call in the precinct workers from that precinct, and we said, "What is there a reason why these two things don't add up?" And there was a reason, but they just hadn't signed the right thing, and it was all okay. But the thought would be that if we get a close election, we really do care who voted under each name, that we'll still be able to back it out. And it might slow it down. I think that if you're thinking about how the canvass will work, if you have to go through this with each vote, in a very close election, it probably will take longer to get the outcome, but at least we hope we'll get the right outcome if we do it that way.
Yeah, I have one final question. I understand the law in Virginia forbids parole to those given a life sentence in prison in Virginia. Are there any exceptions to this, or is there a possibility that the law might be changed to become more lenient?
You might as well take it.
Let me tell you what the law is, and then I'll answer the rest of it. There's a couple things that are there are three questions buried in that question. The first would be Virginia does not have parole. We have something called truth in sentencing, which means whatever you are sentenced to, you will serve 85% of it. So if you get a 10-year sentence, you'll serve 8.5 years. 20-year sentence would be 17. If you get life, you serve life. And so parole doesn't have anything to do with the life sentence. It just means there's no early out. Now, in Maryland, for instance, if you get a 20-year sentence, you will serve some small portion of that, become eligible for parole, and if they decide to release you, you get released. The only exception that is, the only real exception in Virginia besides a pardon, where the governor just comes in and says, I think you've served enough time, is something called geriatric parole. And we do have a program in Virginia where if you've served a certain amount of your sentence and you are on death's door, basically, they will geriatrically parole you to go home. That is the only parole we have in Virginia. I would not suggest that there is a high likelihood that this will be changed. I mean, this has been policy since 1993 or 4. It is one of the underlying bases for all of our jury verdicts, that the jury gives you a certain amount of time, you get it. A judge gives you a certain amount of time, you get it. When you get out, you might be on probation if that was part of your sentence, but you don't get to get out early because you convince someone that you've changed your views, which was the problem with parole. Thank you.
Okay, well, please join me in thanking our two delegates today.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.